Today is Thursday, November 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Senate votes to end American involvement in the deadly war in Yemen.
We've watched innocent people be killed. We've watched people die of diseases that they shouldn't be dying of, and yet we've continued to not want to cut our nose off to spite our face by doing something that is against our national interest.
U.S. officials give contradicting conclusions about who ordered the killing of Washington Post journalist, a swirl of new information about what might be happening with the Russia investigation. Also ahead, pop sensation Ariana Grande is bringing fans an inside look into her tours in a new documentary. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Senate took a defiant stand on Wednesday by voting overwhelmingly to move forward in a non-binding resolution ending U.S. military support to the Saudi-led coalition fighting in Yemen. Wednesday's vote means the Senate could start debating the resolution as early as next week. Many of the lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, are not just concerned over the humanitarian calamity caused by the fighting. They're also upset with President Trump's reluctance to punish the Saudis for the killing of Washington Post writer Jamal Khashoggi. Before Wednesday's vote, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis appeared before the Senate to defend U.S. involvement in Yemen. Pompeo said if the U.S. were not involved, things would be much worse.
We are on the cusp of allowing the U.S. envoy Martin Griffiths to, in December, gather the parties together and hopefully get a ceasefire in Yemen, something that we have diplomatically been striving for months, and we think we're right on the cusp of that. And so it is the view of the administration, Secretary Mattis and myself, that passing a resolution at this point undermines that.
Saudi-led airstrikes against Houthi rebels include weapons bought from the United States. They've killed thousands of Yemeni civilians, destroyed hospitals, and wiped out entire neighborhoods. VOA's Victor Beatty got reaction on the Senate vote from Gregory Johnson, former member of the Yemen panel of experts for the UN Security Council.
So this is a vote that was defeated in the Senate earlier this year, back in March. And, of course, a lot of things have happened in U.S.-Saudi relationship between March and now. And I think that accounts for the fact that this vote, which failed earlier this year, has now passed. And I think one of the most important things that this vote in the Senate does is that it opens up a debate about what exactly the U.S. is doing in the war in Yemen, which is now in its fourth year, and how the U.S. can play an active role in bringing this war to an end. But you're absolutely right. It's very much pushback from Congress, from the Senate, against President Trump and against what this administration, as well as the previous administration, has been doing in Yemen.
To the point that Pompeo tried to make that this would only worsen the conflict, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a debatable question. The argument from both the Obama administration previously and now the Trump administration currently has been that U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen or U.S. support for Saudi Arabia has made Saudi Arabia more calculating, has made Saudi Arabia more careful when it is carrying out its airstrikes that are targeting the Houthis, who have control over large portions of Yemen. Unfortunately, there's no evidence to really suggest that the Saudis are taking into consideration what it is that the U.S. is advising them to do, or that they're in any way mitigating civilian casualties. In fact, just last week, the U.S. has decided to stop refueling Saudi planes over exactly this issue.
Wanted to talk to you briefly about the Khashoggi murder. The Secretary of State insisting that there's no clear evidence that the Crown Prince was involved in any way with this murder at the Saudi consulate at Istanbul, but the CIA perhaps suggesting otherwise. Where do you come down on this?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in intelligence, there rarely is a smoking gun. What it is that you put together a lot of different pieces, and quite often the pieces of evidence that you acquire, they point you in a particular direction. And I think that's where the CIA came down. I think everyone who spends a lot of time watching what's happening in Saudi Arabia within the Arabian Peninsula, I don't think anyone who is informed about the region has any doubt that Mohammed bin Salman was in some way responsible for the murder of Khashoggi.
Another point Mr. Pompeo made was that this vote is ill-timed given that we're on the cusp of peace talks in Sweden next month.
Yeah, that's another point. I actually think that this vote worked against what Secretary of State Pompeo said. I think that this vote could do a lot to actually bring the Saudis to the bargaining table in a position where they're ready to make the difficult compromises of peace. What we have right now in Yemen is Saudi Arabia and the Houthis, who they're primarily fighting. Neither side is really paying the price for war. That is, Saudi Arabia isn't seeing a lot of body bags come home. There isn't a lot of domestic pressure at home for Mohammed bin Salman to withdraw from this war. The Houthis, likewise, aren't facing, by and large, the Houthi leadership is not bearing the brunt of this war. It's the Yemeni civilians that are suffering from this war. So there's not a lot of pressure. So a vote like today's vote in the Senate, I think, could actually be very constructive in putting some pressure on Saudi Arabia so that they'll be in a position and willing to negotiate and make the difficult compromises for peace when it comes to peace talks in Sweden.
The UN aid chief Mark Lowcock is traveling to Yemen this week. He's warning, of course, of mass starvation. The fighting has been centered around Hodeida, a key port facility that allows aid in. What's the latest there?
So the fighting has been going on in and around Hodeida for several months. This summer, there was an uptick. More recently, in early November, there was a lot of fighting around the port. That sort of dropped off. But on a daily basis, there's mortars that are being lobbed back and forth. There's fighting that's going on, but we're not seeing, at least at the moment, the sort of offensive that would aim to push the Houthi rebels out of their entrenched positions.
That's Gregory Johnson, former member of the Yemen Panel for Experts for the UN Security Council. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Vladimir Putin blames the Ukrainian president for the naval standoff in the Black Sea. President Trump is willing to shut down the government over border wall funding. A Russian detainee dies in U.S. immigration custody. And a gold rush is enriching Malawi farmers. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump Wednesday said a pardon for his former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, is not off the table, a comment that drew swift rebuke from critics who fear the president will use his executive power to protect friends and supporters caught up in the Russia probe. The president's discussion of a possible pardon in an interview with the New York Post came days after special counsel Robert Mueller said Manafort had breached his plea deal by repeatedly lying to investigators. Manafort denies that he lied. U.S. intelligence agencies say Russia was the source of hacked material from Democratic organizations that WikiLeaks released during the 2016 presidential campaign. Mueller is investigating whether any Trump associates had advanced knowledge of WikiLeaks' plans. Joining us now, Robert Deitz, professor of governmental policy at George Mason University. So why would someone lie or agree to a plea deal and then risk everything by lying?
That helps improve his position with the president. You know, that is, the president will feel increasingly grateful for one's loyalty and thereby perhaps put forth a pardon.
Manafort's legal team feeding the president's attorneys information on what Manafort told Mr. Mueller and what the questions were. What sort of risk does that pose for Manafort or the president or, for that matter, any of these attorneys?
That's a great question, and I've spent a fair amount of the day thinking about that. There are a lot of lawyers in Washington. Everybody jokes about how many lawyers there are, but in fact, it's a relatively small community, and people develop reputations, and when lawyers develop reputations, they tend to stick. It's very hard to shake a bad reputation, or for that matter, a good reputation. Reputations tend to hold, and I know that I would not want to be a lawyer who appears to be misleading a set of prosecutors. Having said that, I don't think that any of that is illegal. That is, I don't think, you know, unless they made a pledge not to, and I don't think they did, there's nothing wrong with leaving a prosecutor's office and going to some other attorney and say, here's what they've told me, in the same way that they could do that with the press.
Would coordinating answers with Mueller, would that...
That would be a problem.
But would that be witness tampering, obstruction? Is it illegal?
Possibly all of that. The problem is that Manafort's attorneys are not fools, and they know that as well. And what they may have done is create what in the old days was called a Chinese wall. That is, have Manafort speak to one of the attorneys, and that attorney in turn doesn't speak to any of his colleagues about what he's learned. And that the idea of that is to isolate, prevent any claims about witness tampering or obstruction or any of the other bad things that you can do. Again, I want to emphasize this is all speculation. I would love to see a hard fact about almost anything. It's really frustrating. For example, you asked the question, why would somebody do that? That's a great question. I've never seen it done before. And in fact, I'm not sure I've ever even heard of it being done. And I'm not sure what one gains. It seems to me that the risk is that one gains enormous hostility from the man who's supposed to say nice things about you during the sentencing phase of your trial.
Do you think in all likelihood that this pretty much guarantees that the president will be giving Manafort a pardon, given that he is basically feeding him information about what he was being asked?
No, I don't think it guarantees that at all. I'm not sure that Mr. Trump cares enough about other people. So far as I can tell, everybody, and I mean literally everybody, who's had some involvement with Mr. Trump during his presidency has had his reputation permanently marred. You know, whether it's Cohen or Flynn or, you know, the whole pack of them. One ends up dealing with Mr. Trump and one's reputation is gone.
Could Mueller bring charges against Manafort or any of these attorneys? Manafort's in particular, agreeing to a plea deal and then going and giving the information to one of the people and being investigated.
He lied, according to Mr. Mueller, during a time when he had pledged to be open and honest. That creates the same problem that got him into trouble in the first place, namely not answering questions of the FBI honestly. And so that brings in a whole nother 5, 10, 15, 20 years potential imprisonment. If you set that aside, the question is, what did he do and does it constitute grounds for witness tampering or some of the other crimes surrounding trial behavior? And I don't know enough facts. I just don't know.
It's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental policy at George Mason University. Amid escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine, the State Department condemned a dangerous escalation of Russia's aggressive behavior toward Ukraine and said the United States continues to support Ukraine's territorial integrity. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
Russia is accusing Ukrainian sailors of illegally crossing Russian waters and ignoring warnings from border guards, and sentenced them to 2 months of detention. The sentence has angered Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, who, along with a growing number of European leaders, is calling for additional Western sanctions on Russia. In Washington, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert also condemned Moscow's actions.
It's a dangerous escalation on the part of Russians' continued aggressive behavior against Ukraine. The United States continues to support Ukraine's territorial integrity. The Secretary and the President both have a very strong relationship with the government in Ukraine, President Poroshenko in particular.
Nauert said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is heading to Brussels next week for NATO meetings, and that Ukraine will likely be a big topic of conversation. She called on Europe to do more to assist Kiev. A number of foreign policy experts also blamed Russia for the escalating tensions.
We know that Russia is at fault here. We know that they're still holding Ukrainians essentially as hostages, which is beyond any definition of acceptable behavior by a modern civilized state.
Sorochuk said Moscow has been trying to destabilize Ukraine for the past 5 years.
They're trying to show another example of how Ukraine is unable to protect its borders. And is an illegitimate regime or an illegitimate government. And it's just another, as I said, another building block in Moscow's narrative that Ukraine, democratic Ukraine, cannot be allowed to survive and prosper.
Some experts warned the tensions could spiral out of control.
If President Poroshenko, knowing he has elections coming up, if he thinks it'll be very popular to retaliate, then one thing could lead to another and we could have a major war on our hands.
Coffey said in the current situation, everyone needs to remember it was Russia that invaded Ukraine in 2014, and it is Russia that occupies Crimea. He called for a strong response from President Donald Trump. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Senior officials from Greece and neighboring Macedonia are seeking to end decades of tension with an agreement that would see Greece's neighbor change its name to North Macedonia. Both sides have taken a series of actions aimed at refraining from hostile actions or rhetoric with the proposed agreement, and it comes as protesters opposing the plan marched through the capital on Wednesday. Europe-based journalist Amy Gutman just returned from Macedonia, and she joins us now. Why is this vote so important?
So for 27 years, Greece and Macedonia have been at odds over the name of the country Macedonia. And that's because there's some shared history and Greece lays claim to this name. In fact, if you look at a map of Greece, there is an area called Macedonia. This debate has gotten more contentious in recent years when at one point political leaders of Macedonia have felt so strongly about claiming this name and this heritage and this identity that they've actually erected statues of Alexander the Great, and they named the airport with specific names to kind of provoke the Greeks. So there's been tension, and the tension has been sometimes a bit hotter, sometimes a bit cooler, but a new government took over last year. And largely as a result of that new government who took power last year, there was a proposal by Prime Minister Zaev in Macedonia to change the name to North Macedonia to appease the Greeks. Now, this has been very controversial, and certainly a lot of Macedonians are divided about this. Even among family members, there is great divide about this. But the ultimate goal here has always been to make peace with Greece. Why does that matter so much? Especially because the two nations already trade quite a bit. That's important because until recently, Greece has blocked. That's important because Greece has continually blocked entry to not only NATO, but also the EU for Macedonia. And Macedonia is a small country. Its economy has largely been stagnant. It would desperately like to join NATO. It would also ultimately like to join the EU. And until this name change occurs, Greece will and has blocked it at every turn.
If it's that important to Macedonians, why did it take so long to actually vote on this?
Two words: national pride. Anyone you talk to in Macedonia will tell you that the real attachment to this issue and this debate is a simple cultural identity, national pride. Nobody wants the name of their country to change. And of course, this is an emotional issue that we can all relate to. What seems to be happening is that there's a younger generation, and by younger, I largely mean people who are 50 and under. And this younger generation sees the bigger picture. They see the value of peace with Greece. They see the value of their economy having a chance to turn around with membership into NATO, with membership ultimately into the EU. They're aware and they're very pragmatic about the fact that their government needs to clean up its act. They have a lot of corruption still in Macedonia. There are many things that will need to change. These valued and prized membership aren't automatic, but Greece will lift its sort of unofficial blockade against Macedonia once they commit to the name change, which of course they have. And the real key here too among this younger generation is that they say, look, we're not happy about the name change any more than our grandparents are. It's just that we want to end this 27-year-old dispute because we have children now. We want a better future for them. We want better health care for them. We want better education, more opportunities for them. We want our government to be forced to clean up its act, and it's only going to do that if the opportunity to join the EU is on the table. And in fact, a couple things have changed. For example, despite the fact that Greece and Macedonia represent sort of very large trading partners between the two countries, interesting things like Aegean Air has only been allowed to resume flights recently, and that's the Greek national carrier. So you sort of question, well, why? Why weren't they allowed to run these flights previously if there's already trade? Well, that's because of some of these odd stipulations. For example, because of the previous name of the airport in Skopje, the capital of Macedonia, and because of the fact that it rubbed the Greeks the wrong way and it was not officially recognized by the Greek government, there's no way that the national carrier could operate flights there because that location wasn't technically recognized by their own government. So even though it's only an 8-hour drive, from Greece to Skopje, and many people do that eight-hour drive, you can imagine the kind of impact this will have on the local economy. One more European carrier making entry, even with twice-weekly flights into Skopje, it's a big deal. It's going to bring a lot more business people into the city.
So when does this name change take effect?
That's an excellent question. The vote has already occurred, and there's a small group that continues to protest almost daily. And some people contend that because not enough people voted, because a certain percentage of the population did not hit the mark that they needed to hit in order to qualify for a valid vote, that the vote is invalid. Now, the Prime Minister has said that's not the case. We got enough votes for this to pass, and it is going through. Prime Minister still needs to get the approval of Parliament. Some are contending that this will get held up in Parliament. Meantime, the Prime Minister is saying this will not get held up in Parliament because anyone who opposes it is going to have problems, essentially sort of throwing his weight around, saying, look, you either vote for this or you're going to be out. That's sort of how business is done in certain parts. And I don't really know whether he has a legal standing here, but he has said very strongly that he is intent on getting this passed in Parliament.
European-based journalist Amy Gutman. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, 3 years after sealing a global climate deal in Paris, world leaders will gather again next week in Poland to agree on the fine print. A recent report by the International Panel on Climate Change warned that time's running out if the world wants to achieve the most ambitious target in the Paris Agreement. Joining us now is Michelle Courtwright, a restaurateur and climate activist who's going to be attending the conference as a delegate and part of her work to educate through food choices. You've recently opened up a plant-based restaurant with a mission to educate people about how their food choices help reduce their carbon footprint. So tell us how this all came about.
Well, I've been vegetarian for 20 years, and I have always wanted to open a vegetarian restaurant. And a couple of years ago, I hosted a big series at my house. It was open to the public, whoever wanted to come. And it was basically educating people about how climate change and food are closely tied and how a plant-based diet offers a 70% lower carbon footprint. And so I thought that was interesting, and I decided that I wanted to pursue it. I actually was diagnosed with breast cancer in between then and had to sit out for a few months, which kind of made it more important and urgent all at the same time. And when I was done, I had a lot more energy to put toward it after I had healed a bit. So that was really exciting for me.
So obviously you have a passion for plant-based food and you have a passion for climate change. I think a lot of people don't understand that their food choices can actually make a difference when it comes to climate change.
Yeah, you know, I am finding that most people are unaware that livestock production contributes more greenhouse gases than all of the transportation sector combined. So that's every car, train, plane, bus combined. We're still contributing more greenhouse gases with livestock. So it's really something that we can all adapt to pretty easily. We can reduce the amount of meat. I think I saw a study from the University of Chicago that said if Americans ate just one meal less per week of meat, it would be the equivalent of taking 500,000 cars off the road annually. So these are really big numbers, and it's a really important message to get out.
When people say, well, I can't, my diet isn't going to have an impact, just one individual, this would take everybody to stop eating meat, what would you say to them?
I think at this point, climate change is an existential issue, and I think we all need to do our part. I think along with maybe things like voting, it's one of those things that if we all commit to doing it, we do make a big change.
You're also actually doing a lot of activism beyond the restaurant and beyond serving food. Tell us about it.
Yes, we're doing some really great things. So Fig and Pharaoh is our restaurant that's based in Minneapolis, and our whole team, we pride ourselves on being activists in climate change. So one of the first things that we got started was working with the Minneapolis Public School System and becoming their official plant-based protein partner. And what we're doing with that is bringing plant-based eating into cafeterias in the Minneapolis school system. So that's really fun. Locally, we started a climate series salon and supper club, kind of just to have a low-key way for people to connect on climate change and talk about ways that we can all make this better. And of course, doing it over food is amazing. And then we're very honored to be selected as part of a business delegation by Will Steger's Climate Generation. And we will be going to the United Nations Conference on Climate Change. It's called COP24, and it's in Poland in December. So we're going to be blogging about food and how it relates to climate change there. So really fun things. Again, food is just a great connector, and it's a great way for us to address climate change without having to, you know, have sweeping policy reform. It's something we can all do right now, three times a day every time we eat.
And I also understand that you actually have encouraged the mayor of Minneapolis to issue some sort of proclamation. What's that about?
We met the mayor and his team at a climate change conference, and many don't know this, but Minneapolis is way ahead of the game as far as decreasing emissions. And so we asked the mayor to issue a proclamation for the city to eat less meat. That's a very obvious way we can keep decreasing our carbon footprint as a city. And he agreed. And so he issued the proclamation to eat less meat, and he also joined us as our first host at our climate change series. So that's been a really fun partnership, and we look forward to more steps we can take as a city.
What about people that come to your restaurant and they bring someone with them that is a meat eater? How do you convince people that they can still enjoy food without meat? Do you have certain things that you have them try? Do you talk to them about the educational part of it? Or how do meat eaters react to the food that you serve?
Well, I think meat eaters generally think that, you know, plant-based diets have to have tofu and meat substitutes. Our restaurant, our chef, we're a chef-driven restaurant, and we really focus on the food and the vegetables and making them come to life. So when people eat at our restaurant, they have an amazing food experience. They almost don't even think about that they are missing anything off the plate. So that's really cool. And then we have a lot of people, they might be younger and, you know, trying out plant-based diets, and they'll bring in people from their family. And it's really neat. It's really inspiring to see so many people say, I had no idea that eating meat had anything to do with climate change. And so we feel like that education is happening. But also they leave really satisfied with a meal that they can't get in very many places. It is protein-packed. They will not leave hungry. The top food trends of 2018 and 2019 continue to be plant-based cooking with chefs. And it's a new frontier. Chefs are doing amazing things with plant-based food these days.
It's Michelle Courtwright, climate activist and owner of plant-based restaurant Fig and Pharaoh.
We wanted to bring you as closely into our world as possible.
I don't know who had this idea.
Pop star Ariana Grande giving fans an all-access pass into her musical life through a new documentary series on YouTube. Grande will be featured in Ariana Grande Dangerous Woman Diaries, a four-part series set to launch today on the singer's YouTube channel. The series will show highlights from the making of Grande's latest album, Sweetener, which debuted at number one on the Billboard Top 200 chart in August. The documentary will also show new footage from her Dangerous Woman tour, which was suspended after a terrorist bombing killed 22 people and injured more than 500 at Manchester Arena in May of 2017. Parts of Grande's One Love Manchester concert helped raise money for the bombing victims, and that will also be shown. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.